Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, October 30th, 2025. The headline on the News Gazette is Champagne Firm Announces Succession Plan. Co-CEOs will succeed Kozad, who will stay as board chairman. Financial advisory firm that has been in business for more than 50 years will see major changes to its leadership team at the start of 2026. Kozad Asset Management has announced that Brett Anderson and Day Kang will become co-CEOs and succeed Greg Kozad, who will serve as the chairman of the board. Anderson, currently a portfolio manager and investment advisor, will also succeed Ron Cadu as chief investment officer. Kang, currently an investment advisor, will become president of CAM, another role currently held by Kozad. Additionally, Ann Storsved and Katie Burkett will both serve as executive vice presidents, succeeding Mary McGrath. Burkett is currently an investment advisor, and Storsved serves as director of tax, portfolio manager, and investment advisor. Braden Anderson, who has served as chief financial officer since 2020, will also take on the role of chief operating officer, currently held by Stu Meacham. All of these changes will take effect on January 1, 2026, company officials said. Additionally, Kozad, Cadu, McGrath, and Meacham will continue to serve on CAM's board of directors alongside Brett Anderson, Kang, Storsved Burkett, and independent director B. Joseph White. Kozad Asset Management has never been stronger, Kozad said. Ron, Mary, Stu, and I are confident in the values and abilities of these young leaders and excited about the energy they and the entire staff of CAM are bringing to our business. The four of us will continue to advise clients and oversee investments while also serving in the governance of the firm. CAM officials said the leadership changes mark the culmination of a five-year process to ensure continued success of Kozad Asset Management for decades into the future. The company was founded in 1972 by V. Dale Kozad, father of Greg. CAM manages over $2.5 billion in assets for clients in over 40 states as of September 30, 2025. And there's a photo on the front of the News Gazette with the headline, Feeling Groovy, and the caption, Orange Crush members Carter Haney and Nathan Spangler practice their moves at the student section's annual tip-off event Wednesday at State Farm Center. Illini basketball teams, band members, and cheerleaders joined the Crush ahead of Monday's regular season opener. Guatemalan gets 30 years for fatal Urbana hit and run. A man charged in a hit and run that led to the deaths of two young women in Urbana in January pleaded guilty to five counts last week and was sentenced to 30 years in prison. Julio Cacul Bull, 29, a citizen of Guatemala, was charged with two counts of failure to report a crash involving a death, two counts of aggravated driving under the influence, two counts of reckless homicide, and failure to report a crash involving injury. The charges resulted from a January 19th rear-end crash that resulted in the deaths of Chloe Polson, 21, of Deerfield, and Katie Abraham, 20, of Glenview. He pleaded guilty to all of the charges other than the two counts of reckless homicide and received a sentence of 4 years on each count of failure to report a crash, 8 for one count of aggravated driving under the influence, and 26 for the other aggravated DUI charge. The difference between the two counts is that one regarded causing a crash involving deaths, while the other regarded causing a crash involving injury. Two other women in the vehicle were left with minor injuries, and a third sustained broken ribs and vertebrae, according to State's Attorney Julia Reitz. The crash was first reported by a Carle Foundation Hospital security guard, who heard it happen at around 1:55 a.m. at the intersection of University Avenue and Kohler Avenue. A red Mitsubishi Outlander had rear-ended a Honda Civic that was stopped at the red light there, which is near the entrance to Carle's emergency room, Reitz said. Data police later obtained from the airbag and deployment controls in each vehicle confirmed the Honda was stopped while the Mitsubishi was traveling at 78 miles per hour leading up to the collision. Reitz said the Mitsubishi's driver, later identified as Bull, had made little or no attempt to steer away and did not brake until half a second before the crash. The Urbana Fire Department responded and removed the five women from the Honda. As first responders arrived, there was no one in the Mitsubishi, according to police. It was registered to a Juan Sanz Suarez, who had apparently left multiple forms of identification, such as paperwork from Chase Bank and Mexican identification documents, inside the vehicle that investigators discovered. They also found two open cans of Modelo beer in the console, alongside a watch and black hat with a ladybug applique, which would later be used to help identify the suspect. Sanz Suarez had multiple prior registered addresses, including one in Urbana. There, police met with another person who said they had been out with Sanz Suarez on January 18th in the early morning of January 19th. The witness described going to multiple bars over the course of the night and having many drinks, driving from one location to the next. At the third bar they visited, the witnesses said he and Sanz Suarez argued and got physical, which led to Sanz Suarez being removed by security. The witness told police he didn't see the other man again, but received multiple phone calls from him saying he was in a crash and needed money to leave the country. U.S. Marshals arrested a man carrying Mexican documents under the name Juan Sanz Suarez on January 22nd. He was also carrying pages of handwriting samples practicing a signature in that name. Department of Homeland Security agents spoke with the man, who told them the documents were falsified and his real name was Julio Cucul Bull. Investigators obtained footage from all three bars Bull and the witness visited that night, and at the last he had been seen being thrown out just before 1:39 a.m. on the day of the crash. Outside security footage showed him getting into a Mitsubishi at 1:52 a.m. before driving north on Walnut Street, before turning right to head east on University Avenue. Investigators also obtained GPS data from a phone in Bull's possession and saw that it followed that same path and was last at the intersection of University and Kohler at 1:54 a.m. before disconnecting from the Mitsubishi's Bluetooth. Jim Dye's column from the front page. Grayson's conviction will not end controversy. When it comes to law enforcement, there's no defense to stupidity and incompetence. At the same time, there is no substitute for a professional demeanor and good judgment. Hotheads need not apply for the difficult job law enforcement officer, but they do. Some get hired. The tragic consequences of a bad hire have been on display for the past 2 weeks in a Peoria courtroom. That's where 31-year-old Sean Grayson, an individual unsuited by personality to become a police officer, was convicted Wednesday of second-degree murder in connection with his fatal July 2024 shooting of a mentally ill woman who had called the Sangamon County Sheriff's Office over her concerns about suspected prowlers. What should have been a non-event, the police response to the unfounded call by Sonia Massey, blew up into a national tragedy that destroyed lives, blackened law enforcement's reputation, and further enlarged the gap between black and white. Pre-trial publicity sparked by community anger forced the case to be moved from Springfield to Peoria. Over the past 14 months, the public has heard this line ad nauseum over the past year. White cops shoots black woman. That, in the light of this country's awful racial history, is all some people needed to know. But former Deputy Sheriff Grayson didn't shoot Massey for reasons of racial animus. He shot her because he wildly and irrationally overreacted. Prosecutors said he was angry, while the defense argued Grayson feared being scalded when she picked up a pot of boiling water. Either way, Grayson's conduct was the antithesis of sound police work. Either way, in the eyes of the law, it was a murder, first or second degree, though a bit with a big difference in penalties. Grayson, who is 31, now faces prison term ranging from 4 to 20 years. The law allows probation, which is highly unlikely under the facts of the case. Had Grayson been convicted of first-degree murder, he would have faced 20 years to life. The conflicting arguments, anger or fear, created a factual dispute that required jurors to act as savants, forced to read Grayson's mind in the few seconds prior to the shooting. What happened is beyond dispute, but proving why it happened was a legal burden prosecutors could not bear. Ultimately, jurors concluded prosecutors failed to prove Grayson guilty of first-degree murder beyond a reasonable doubt. So they went with a lesser but still serious charge of second-degree murder, convicting him of shooting Massey while acting under the unreasonable idea that she posed a genuine threat to him. That won't go down well with Massey's family and supporters. They see only the egregious facts supporting the shooting and the hideous injustice of losing a relative and friend. In that sense, they must feel justice was denied, because it was, in fact, denied. Massey lost her life for no good reason, and it cannot be restored. Grayson, under the imperfections of law, did get justice in an ironic form. The man who never should have worn a badge received the reasoned treatment Massey was denied. And then, in a related article, sheriff's deputy found guilty of second-degree murder, sentencing set for January 29th. A jury on Wednesday convicted an Illinois sheriff's deputy of a second-degree murder, a lesser degree, in the shooting death of Sonia Massey, a black woman who called 911 to report a suspected prowler. Sean Grayson could be sentenced to up to 20 years in prison or even probation. The jury did not convict him of first-degree murder, a crime that carried a sentence of 45 years to life. Massey's supporters were angered by the result. Her father, James Wilburn, called it a miscarriage of justice. She called for help and she was murdered in her own home. Second-degree murder. That is not right. That is not justice for anybody's family. Teresa Haley, a civil rights activist in Springfield, Illinois, told reporters outside the courthouse. Grayson and another deputy arrived at Massey's home in Springfield early on July 6, 2024, after she reported a prowler. He shot the 36-year-old woman after confronting her about how she was handling a pot of hot water on the stove. Grayson and his attorneys argued that he believed he fired his gun in fear that Massey would scald him with hot water. Massey's killing raised new questions about U.S. law enforcement shootings of black people in their homes and prompted a change in Illinois law requiring a fuller transparency on the background of candidates for law enforcement jobs. Grayson, 31, was charged with first-degree murder, but the jury was given the option of considering second-degree murder, which can apply when a defendant faces a serious provocation or believes their action is justified, even if that belief is unreasonable. He will be sentenced on January 29th. State's Attorney John Millhiser declined to comment as he left the courtroom. He was repeatedly praised by Massey's supporters for pursuing a trial that was moved 75 miles north to the Peoria County Courthouse because of intense publicity in Springfield. Defense Attorney Daniel Fultz, declined comment after the verdict. While we believe Grayson's actions deserved a first-degree conviction, today's verdict is still a measure of justice for Sonia Massey, the family's attorneys, Ben Crump and Antonio Romanucci, said after the seven-day trial. Body camera footage recorded by another sheriff's deputy at the scene Dawson Farley, was a key part of the prosecution's case. It showed Massey, who struggled with mental health issues, telling the officers, "Don't hurt me," and repeating, "Please, God." When the deputies entered the house, Grayson saw the pot on the stove and ordered Massey to move it. Massey jumped up to retrieve the pot, and she and Grayson joked about how he said he was backing off from the hot, steaming water. Massey then replied, "I rebuke you in the name of Jesus." Both Grayson and Farley drew their pistols and yelled at Massey to put the pot down. Grayson told investigators he thought her rebuke meant she intended to kill him, and in the following commotion, fired 3 shots, striking Massey just below the eye. Farley testified that Massey didn't say or do anything that caused him to view her as a threat, but under cross-examination, he acknowledged that he initially reported to investigators that he feared for his safety because of the hot water. Farley did not fire his weapon and was not charged. Grayson, who was subsequently fired, testified in his own defense. He told jurors he noticed the bottom of the pot was red, and he believed Massey planned to throw the water at him. He said Massey's words felt like a threat, and that he drew his gun because officers are trained to use force to get compliance. "She done. She can go get it, but that's a headshot," Grayson told Farley after the shooting. "There's nothing you can do, man." Grayson relented moments later and went to get his kit, while Farley found dish towels to apply pressure to the head wound. When Grayson returned, Farley told him his help wasn't necessary, so he threw his kit on the floor and said, "I'm not even going to waste my stuff then." Massey's death forced the early retirement of the sheriff who hired Grayson and generated a U.S. Justice Department inquiry. The federal probe was resolved with Sangamon County Sheriff's Department agreeing to 4 to 5 training, particularly de-escalation practices, develop a program in which mental health professionals can respond to emergency calls, and to generate data on the use of force incidents. Massey's family settled a lawsuit against the county for $10 million, and state lawmakers changed the Illinois law to require fuller transparency on the background of candidates for law enforcement jobs. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Notes from the newsroom. We're winding down year 5 of Farm Family of the Week, but our ag coverage is about to kick into a higher gear. Daily reports from Gail Cunningham, new ag director for Central Illinois Multimedia Group's 11 radio stations, will begin today on WDWS and The Rooster. Starting at 5 a.m., Cunningham will check in up to 12 times a day. The Hall of Famer from Hoopston also will write for the News Gazette. We'll let him settle in and celebrate next month's big honor before rolling out his column. On November 20th in Kansas City, Missouri, Cunningham will be inducted into the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Hall of Fame. The NAFB Hall of Fame, 81 inductees strong, was established in 1986 to recognize pioneers of the industry. Congratulations, Mary Lynn Foster, who was named Best News Reporter at the Illinois Broadcasters Association's annual Silver Dome Awards Banquet in Springfield. Foster's daily reports air on all our radio stations starting at 6 a.m. Teacher of the Week, Terry Bott, first grade, Salt Fork South Elementary School, Sidell. Creating a learning environment. After teaching in her hometown of Danville for 13 years, Terry Bott made the move to Salt Fork South Elementary School last year, where she's in her second year teaching first grade. She consistently goes above and beyond to ensure her students not only understand the material, but also develop a true love for learning, Principal Brian Ellensworth said. Her caring nature is evident in the way she supports and encourages every child, meeting them where they are. Mrs. Bott created a welcoming classroom environment where students feel safe, respected, and valued. Her dedication makes a lasting impact on both her students and our school community. I find my work important because, beyond academics, I am trusted to help students find their strengths, nurture talents, and prepare them with skills for their future. I became a teacher because I have always loved working with kids, and I've always loved learning. Teaching is the best way to combine those two things. To be able to help students and guide them to reach their potential is the best part of the job. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is, throughout the year, I do multiple classroom tips, flips. A flip is when I transform a classroom to go along with what we are learning. For example, we do a reading unit about different habitats from all over the world. At the end of the unit, I turn our classroom into a rainforest, complete with decorative trees, animals, and all things in the rainforest. We spend a couple of days in the rainforest researching, exploring, and reviewing our content. The students love it and have so much fun learning. My most fulfilling moments on the job are when, well, it is hard to choose just one. One of the top moments is always when a student has that light bulb moment and something they have been trying to learn just clicks. I love the small moments too, like enjoying a read aloud or sharing a laugh together. Those are always great too. I keep students engaged by trying my best to incorporate some fun where I can. I like to use little songs, sayings, and movements to make things memorable and engaging. Students love to use their whiteboards and manipulatives to help complete their work. I also incorporate games into our learning whenever possible. Using a variety of activities helps keep students engaged and makes content more interesting. Something else I'm passionate about is, besides spending time with my husband and daughter, I love hand lettering and calligraphy. It's something I have really enjoyed learning, and I like to use to make signs, cards, Christmas ornaments, and for the Bible journaling. My favorite teacher and subject to study in school was, this is a hard one. I have been lucky to have many wonderful teachers throughout my school career. In elementary school, my favorite teacher was my fourth grade teacher, Miss Jones at East Park. She was always encouraging and had a fun way of teaching. I just remember loving fourth grade, and I was always excited to go. If I weren't a teacher, I would be in a career that is still involved working with children, like a counselor or a social worker. We have Mike Hale's Records and Radio column. Speaking of surveys, who'd you like to see play State Farm Center? Follow-up questions before heading down an interesting path in upcoming columns. But first, a quiz question on the eve of Halloween. Name the four number one Halloween-themed songs on Billboard Hot 100, 1958 until today. The Temptations' Four Tops concert at the State Farm Center was a special night where every singer and band member left it all on stage. Not sure how they deliver that kind of show on successive nights. So much laughing and singing. I appreciated everyone who came up to talk to me as we were leaving. During my crowd warm-up on stage, I mentioned I'm fortunate to have direct access to our company team that works with State Farm Center in booking shows. I invited the audience to reach out to me with suggestions on what acts they'd like to see booked at State Farm Center. I received over 250 texts and emails. I'll give our readers the same opportunity. Text me at 217-351-9797 or email mitm@whms.com with who'd you pay to see it, SFC. Several times over the past year, I have displayed various printed music lists generated weekly by radio stations. WLS's Silver Dollar Survey, Hit Parade, and Music Radio 89 lists are the most frequently mentioned. Many readers have asked, is there somewhere you can get access to the lists short of buying them on eBay? Yes, there's a marvelous website, ARSA, Airheads Radio Survey Archive, which is a nonprofit labor of love that has over 193,041 radio station music surveys culled from 4,738 different radio stations. A significant amount of these surveys you can view in full color. All the charts saying song data is meticulously entered into a database so you can cross-reference to see how your favorite songs fared in different markets across the country. You can see names, pictures, and air shift schedules from many of your favorite stations of the past. On average, they add a couple dozen surveys to the site every day. To make use of the site, you need to sign up. There's no spam, no advertising. These are pure survey hobbyists who are persevering, or who are preserving radio history, and that would frankly be lost without their efforts. Here's the site, www.las-solanus.com/arsa. Another resource can be found in book form. The author is Carl Mann, a retired radio broadcaster who worked in engineering and programming in 1962 to 2010. His resume includes two legendary sets of top 40 call letters, KOIL in Omaha, Nebraska, and KOMA in Oklahoma City. He has three books on the biggest top 40 stations of the 1950s and 60s. Each book contains samples of radio station surveys, along with a narrative about each radio station. In some cases, included is the competitive picture in a market, where, for example, KXOK in St. Louis defeating WIL and KWK, WLS taking on WGJD, WYNR, and WCFL, well-researched. Titled Radio Music Surveys, each book covers a different period, 1955 to 60, from the dawn of Top 40 Radio, 1960 to 65, the stations and songs leading to the British invasion, and 1965 to 70, from the burgeoning years of rock. These are self-published books printed in Moni, pretty easy to find. Both the ARSA website and Man Books give you an opportunity to dive into the top 40 stations where you grew up, like the Des Moines, Iowa battle between KIOA and KSO, San Diego KCBQ versus KDEO, and KGB in Dallas KLIF versus KBOX. Finally, congratulations to two co-workers who were Illinois Broadcasters Association Silver Dome Award winners. Mary Lynn Foster won the Best News Reporter. Tamara McDaniel was a top three finalist for the Best Feature with her well-researched Locals program. Once again, I appreciate you taking the time out with feedback and topic ideas. That was Hell. Jamaica, Haiti, and Cuba evaluating extent of damage. Hurricane Melissa left at least dozens dead in a widespread destruction across Cuba, Haiti, and Jamaica, where roofless homes toppled utility poles and waterlogged furniture dominated the landscape Wednesday. A landslide blocked the main roads of Santa Cruz and Jamaica's St. Elizabeth Parish, where the streets were reduced to mud pits. Residents swept water from homes as they tried to salvage belongings. Wind ripped off part of the roof at a high school that serves as a public shelter. The extent of the damage from the deadly Category 5 hurricane was unclear Wednesday as widespread power outages and dangerous conditions persisted. "It's too early for us to say definitively," said Dana Morris Dixon, Jamaica's education minister. Melissa made landfall Tuesday in Jamaica with the top winds of 185 miles per hour, one of the strongest Atlantic hurricanes on record, before weakening and moving on to Cuba. But even countries outside the direct path of the storm felt its devastating effects. At least 23 people have died across Haiti, and 13 are missing, Haiti's Civil Protection Agency said in a statement, revising the death toll downward Wednesday. 20 of those reported dead and 10 of the missing are from a southern coastal town where flooding collapsed dozens of homes. At least 8 are dead in Jamaica. In Cuba, officials reported collapsed houses, blocked mountain roads, and roofs blown off buildings Wednesday, with the heaviest destruction concentrated in the southwest and northwest. Authorities said about 735,000 people remained in shelters. "That was hell all night long. It was terrible," said Reynaldo Chiron in Santiago de Cuba. The 52-year-old was one of the few people venturing out Wednesday, covered by a plastic sheet in the intermittent rain. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, October 30th, 2025. Please stay tuned for Part 2.